state formation, you had to have the people, you had to have the territory, you had to have some legitimacy and common law, and then a state would have coercive means to have the authority to threaten or protect people, whether it's an army or police. All this is for the purpose of taxation.
Greetings and welcome to The Elephant TV. My name is Joe Kobuthi. Today I'll be speaking to Leonard Wanyama. Mr. Wanyama is Regional Coordinator of East Africa Tax and Governance Network. Karibu, Leonard, to The Elephant.
Thank you very much, Joe. It's a pleasure.
So, I mean, to get this conversation starting, how Kenyans, you know, moved towards the Kenyan colony, particularly around tax, was something that is bitter to them. And I think, you know, that's something that is still part of Basel or our psyche towards paying taxes. Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, looking at 1915, there was the Native Ordnance Act, which passed. Under that, there was the Kipane tax and the Brass tax. Mm-hmm. So where men were required to pay, you know, Brass tax for the number of women in their communities, but also they were paying also Kipane tax. So and since they didn't have that money, they were forced to move to the cities,
yeah,
or to work for the British in their plantations, so they can get the coin to pay taxes.
Yeah.
What would you say as someone who's in the tax space?
Yeah. So for me, whenever I think about tax historically, it takes me back to my political science 101 class. They tell us that state formation, you had to have the people, you had to have the territory, you had to have some legitimacy and common law, and then a state would have coercive means to have the authority to threaten or protect people, whether it's an army or police. Now, what never came out and what is essentially what happened to us, it's just that not many people kind of join that dot, is that all this is for the purpose of taxation, or the gel in terms of putting all these people together, maintaining or determining that territory and so forth, is all about tax. Because once you have the tax system in place, you have a state forming. Now, for instance, in our history, it's all through a coercive process, whether it's by intimidation or through violence. And hence, our state formed itself in a very coercive and violent process, not only just by beating people and moving them around, but also in terms of getting the resources to make it a sustainable colony. And so over the years, this process essentially has never really included the people in that process. And so in the sense of Kenyan history, then you look at our constitution today, the revolutionary aspect of the constitution is the fact that it determines and insists that there is some form of public participation in revenue generation, allocation, expenditure, and so forth. Because that is a bit of the process of redressing that history throughout the formation of Kenya as a country.
We come back to the constitution, but just to walk you back slightly, I mean, political science 101, Kenya was an extractive state.
Yes.
I mean, the logic of Kenya as it was built by the British was to extract resources from the natives, but also from the land.
Yes.
Out of Kenya to go into what they call the global north.
Mm-hmm.
Today we're having a similar debate, but it seems still part of that trajectory.
Mm-hmm.
Where I think in 2014, Oxfam released a report saying that every year $44 billion comes into the continent, but around $192 billion leaves the continent. You've just mentioned to me earlier that the estimations in East Africa is $1 billion leaves every year.
Yeah.
How is it that to date we are still yet to address this kind of loopholes?
Because we have never addressed the economic structure of the post-colonial state.
Mm.
You look at the design of roads, look at the design of infrastructure, placement of towns, and so forth. It has never really shifted. And so the extraction is still happening. Mm. Essentially, part of the development discourse has to look at how they need to change the value chain system to show or to address the needs of the people. So for instance, I used to work at a place where we'd ask, why is it that the abundant maize harvest in Tanzania can't reach people in northeastern Kenya, yet we're in the same regional block, or vegetables from Kitale have to struggle to reach Turkana because there's no road and so forth. So there is a conversation that we need to have in terms of what is the value chain and where are we supposed to be supplying this? And across that value chain is also an accompanying tax system. And so essentially we are in an extractive economy, colonial, post-colonial or so forth. The structure, the economic structure has never really changed. Now, that value chain, if we change it, then we start addressing the needs, the economic needs, the nutritional needs and so forth of people across East Africa. And so it is no surprise that funds move out that way, because even the financial system is somewhat geared that way. Because again, there are preferences for multinationals. There is added advantages. And so it won't be a surprise that a lot of this money leaves the region or the country. What is interesting is the place of what I'd call legal money leaving the region or the continent at large. So when we talk of illicit financial flows, these funds where we would say that there's the legal money and there's the immoral money that leaves. The illegal money I'd call corruption and criminal enterprise. But now there's the immoral money that lives in that. You are not raising, you're not capturing the revenue that you need for service delivery needs. So what happens is you have created loopholes where countries or companies or entities that are aggressively seeking to avoid tax can whisk away money that should actually be going to help some of your service delivery and social welfare needs. And so that whole cosmos of money leaving is what we call illicit financial flows, and where we keep addressing through activities in the tax justice movement in the region and the continent as a whole.
Speaking of international financial flows, particularly around the development space, yeah. There's also been an argument that has been placed that this money is leaving developing nations, and it's going to rich nations. Yes. Yet, these rich nations are the ones still giving these developing nations aid from one form or the other.
Yeah.
And yet, increasingly, people are saying, "But it's your banks that are taking part in this. It's your lawyers." The recent Pandora Papers have shown, you know, the UK, London, as a hub for dark money.
Yes.
How do you explain this contradiction, and how do you begin to resolve this kind of convoluted logic whereby it's really taking from Peter and paying Paul?
It's a sleight of hand. That's the best way I can describe it. It's essentially a sleight of hand because you come into a space, take the advantages, whisk the money away, and come back again with demands when you're giving them aid or support of any kind that again make things very, very hard for them to deal with what are their needs and their national interests. It's a carryover of the colonial state. It's a carryover of neocolonialism and neoliberalism, all intertwined in one. But it is a clear sleight of hand, in my opinion, because why would you then be ranking corruption without thinking of the banks that are involved? Because if you look at the corruption index, for instance, a good chunk of the countries that show up as the best countries that have no corruption are actually residences for the dark money and the illicit financial flows. So you can clearly see the contradiction there. So essentially playing around with the definition of corruption in that sense. So it's a clear sleight of hand. And so we have to engage and struggle to make the point about the impact of this structure and the fact that it affects people down to the village level in our countries, because we are living some form of contradiction and not keeping up to the so-called standards that we profess in terms of democracy and freedom.
And then what would you say the last couple of, say, months, how, for instance, the UK has been, one could argue, aggressive around addressing this issue. What would you say has led to that? Was it the Pandora Papers? What would you say has led to that?
Essentially, if you look at it, there's definitely a self-interest in terms of bringing up new standards and putting them in place. With the war in Ukraine and Russia, the oligarch money is definitely a vulnerability in their economic system. And so for them, as a security measure, they have to then work faster in that regard. But at the point when everything was good and they were all making money out of it, they hadn't seen this vulnerability. And so it's a self-preservation thing. Now, how is it we cannot think of ourselves in this discussion from a self-preservation point of view? Because if 20 million lives, and yet if you took 20 million in a ward from where I come from, in Bungoma, it would make a world of change there for schools, hospitals, roads, electricity, and so forth. So we have to take up arms intellectually in pushing back in terms of how money is leaving our countries, because that is essentially how the feet of clay of the Kenyan state keeps getting built and destroyed. Then countries collapse and so forth. Especially now with the economic situation, I think a lot of countries are feeling the pressure and the risk of possible revolutions. If you take the example of Sri Lanka, for instance.
Right. Speaking of the economic situation that we are in, we're also in an election season, and in about two and a half weeks,
yes.
Kenya is going to the poll,
mm-hmm.
and. Part of the narrative around these elections has been around the economy, mm-hmm. and particularly around the deputy president. Deputy President William Ruto has really pushed the economy argument,
mm-hmm.
and talking about bottom up and etc. And even Azimio, they have also caught on to that, and they're trying to also cobble up economic imperatives towards influencing the voter to pick whichever side,
yeah.
of the divide. In your view, as a tax justice expert,
mm.
do you feel as if either or both manifestos have addressed the issue of really changing the nature of our economic structure?
Mm.
And and to that extent, also having an imperative around a fair tax regime.
Mm.
Do you feel like either one of the manifestos has addressed that?
So I would say in the context of the election, because I see this as an evolutionary process, as I mentioned about the constitution, we've had almost a 20-something year conversation about rights. The conversation that's now here about the economy is the conversation about responsibilities. And so to me, it comes as no surprise that they all fell back to talk about the economy, whether they speak about it very specifically or whatnot. That conversation about the economy is ripe because we now have to shift the responsibility. Who does what in order to ensure development coming into place? I would say for both, they are in some kind of contest to push the country into a describe it as a fiscal democracy. Better practices and new standards that would fit the Kenyan context and thereby get to the point of fair taxation. Because whichever of them comes into power, they will have to address questions of public participation. They'll have to address questions of gender. They'll have to address questions of devolution. And so obviously based on their political formation and baggage, it would play into the policy. But nonetheless, it would be the next step into, as I've described, the fiscal democracy. So the standard about how much will go to the counties. That is something that's very interesting to see. For me, especially, whoever can deliver that moves the needle forward. The question of how we raise taxes and ensure services are delivered. So if I am a person selling my wares in a market, when I give out my 100 shillings and I get my receipt, when do I get the toilet in the marketplace? How fast? How accountable are they to me? How empowered am I? Is it going through a process of the rule of law? And those would be human rights-based principles infused in your tax policy. So these are, it's a serious space of contestation where, for instance, we will then see more of whether we'll have small efficient governments or big governments that cater in terms of maybe social welfare and whatnot. So that is just going to be a constant push and pull for whichever government coming after this one, or especially, or coming after this conversation. So for me, I see it more as evolution. And for citizens, it's important for them to think very hard in terms of who will be delivering those things to them. Your MP is very important. They determine the legislation on finances, down to the Committee on Finance and Planning, budget, and so forth. Your senator is also very important because he oversights the governor. And then as after you have those two, you have then, I'd call now the governor's somebody of those two, the third most important person. He's an implementer. Then the presidency, another implementer. So an implementer who can actually just deliver our aspirations and ideals in line with how we are thinking about the monies that are going to the counties or the constituencies and so forth, succeeds and wins. But also the legislator who can actually prioritize and debate and develop the law that brings that efficiency and democracy, because there's a need to open up that space. It's a niche space. It's really captured. My colleagues had to fight to even determine that you have to have a space in public policy and through public participation through the courts of law. So that is the tug of war that is going into the responsibility. It's actually now phase two of having a free society. And so that's how I'm really looking at it in terms of this.
Nice. I mean, you mentioned the Constitution, how the Constitution has really opened up the space. I mean, we have Chapter 6, yeah. Chapter 4, Chapter 11 on devolution, yes. Public finance. So, and you're talking about all this in the context of fiscal democracy. Mm. But how do you, what's the tension between fiscal democracy when we're still not having a conversation around the economic structure of our society? What do I mean by this? I mean that a lot of our goods and services and products that are produced were still, to quote Nkrumah, mm. were still influenced by a colonial policy. Mm. So how do we navigate that where now we're seeing increasingly more Kenyans want to be part of this economy, mm. but then part of it's still to a certain extent rigged because as our economic structure is still very colonial and extractive, yes. Therefore it'll still marginalize mm. the majority. How do we balance that? The fiscal democracy you're talking about vis-a-vis an economic structure that we're not yet still restructuring to fit our reality. How do we balance that?
When I said that, I spoke and I mentioned the question of new standards. Right. That is exactly the pin to prick the balloon or the bubble to determine and demand new standards for us, essentially presenting the fact that we've been doing this extractive economy for so long, the standard now is no longer the global north. The standard is us. There's no point to that. If I have no toilets in my market, I have no roads in my community, I have no hospitals and so forth. It might be a carryover to some of the development work that has been going around or has been happening, but now it's demanding a standard for us, where we are prioritizing ourselves. And through that process, we are demanding this on a basis of dignity and human rights. So for instance, there are global standards in terms of setting up the system, but those standards never speak to us. And so we have to push ourselves into that conversation. So those best practices and whatnot, if they don't work for us, then we must demand the new standards that fit into our context. And I see this as a daily political and policy contest. We have to win those arguments. We have to put out the data. We have to go into those spaces and demand and say, look, this is not working for us. And if it is to work, it has to think of things this way, because this is the context we live in. These are the communities we serve. These are the areas that need development and so forth. Essentially, that way we would then be addressing the inequalities, because the system as it is perpetuates the inequality. So every inequality you can imagine, to my mind, is essentially based on that system. What happens is that, look, we've had a situation where these things are actually exacerbating this situation. How can we rejig it to our purpose? And that is the daily fight you have to have. And that's the conversation, for instance, in terms of structural transformation. That's how then you determine questions of geographical problems. You have a county A and B that are different. Why should people move from one county to go to the other for a hospital? All the way in terms of even thinking about gender, right? Because in the context of where this economic system comes from, there's a way they think about how you tax a man and a woman. But not for us. Maybe for us, we are looking at it differently. You've seen the conversation that has come up about taxes for that are gender specific.
Right?
So that is now new standards that have to be set. They might mirror what is already going on in the conversations in the world, but then we are going to put in our specifics, the ones that relate to us. In the previous election, you had the question, or even this one, there's been a question about policy around single mothers. Already you can clearly see there is a direction, a contextualization of whether it is a problem or a situation that we feel we need to address. And if tax can do it, then we need to rejig the policy to that effect. So that's essentially on a case-by-case basis, depending whether it's health, society, judicial access, and so forth.
Lastly, Nanda, as we conclude, to what extent, I mean, policy conversations unfortunately leave out the majority of the people,
yeah,
towards issues of their own governance.
Mm.
And taxation is really, it's really part of the livelihood conversation that is shaping up, not just in these elections, but perhaps for the next decade,
yeah,
where, I mean, the central question in Kenya's public sphere for the next couple of years will be the livelihood question and creating governance systems to uphold and to make sure that ordinary Kenyans and Kenyans of all walks of life, that the material conditions are good and sustainable.
Mm.
How do we start having these conversations such that we move them from a particular kind of policy wonkish kind of conversation?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So we start having them, they become mainstream to our public sphere.
Yeah.
So how do we do that, Leonard?
So at the East Africa Tax and Governance Network, we are essentially set up to champion tax justice for sustainable development. Even in that, I don't know how I would explain it to the mama mboga or people in terms of how really it touches on where the shoe pinches. Now, what we realized is that coming from a history where there have been lots of conversations about rights, then we have to go back and base popular conversation on human rights conversations. And so, for instance, we did a study that kind of just put the five pillars of human rights-based advocacy tax conversation. If you can get people to participate in a tax process, that's number one. If you can get them to ask their leadership to be accountable, that's number two. if you can get them to demand the fact that things are not, there's no discrimination in terms of that. That's number three of issues that they understand. Number four, that a tax or a policy conversation or even those should kind of push them towards empowerment. Are they moving from a good place to a better place? And then lastly, the question of legitimacy through the rule of law. Right. They have to ask, was just asking if the process was legal. And to give you an example, Okiya Omtatah has a very big fan base across the common Mwananchi, because he always asks a simple question. Was any law that he's contesting on the basis of the constitution? Very simple. For them, they understand there's a constitution. There might be other supporting legislation. But if your action or decision is breaking the constitution, they will not agree with it. And so they like the way he does it. He just asks a very simple question. And he asks them on very simple matters. He'll ask on something like VAT. They hear about VAT and they feel VAT. So that is the space we need to move people. And that can only be done by somewhat backtracking and bringing back strong civic education activity. Because I think with the constitution, what happened was that we were like, we need to give capacity to the people implementing the new constitution. And then we kind of forgot that the people also have to come along with the constitution so that they can ask these right questions. So essentially that civic education that built people to the point of the constitution that is there now needs to come back so that it can build these people to ask the right questions, to participate, to look forward to go to the next baraza. Because, or even the town hall, we see town halls now as a media production. But these things should be happening more regularly without
media organization. Yeah.
If your chief calls you, you get the urgency to go and stuff like that. Then obviously, when I was talking about non-discrimination, what does it mean in terms of just a simple question like having girls and boys in school at the same time? What do they need? You can have a local program where you say everyone gets shoes and socks during the rainy season. At least jiggers don't touch their feet and they are all in school, because the less time going to hospital or sitting home and whatnot. Or the food thing, the food programs that are in schools today. That's non-discriminatory and that's the idea behind it, right? Things like that. So that civic education really needs to come back, because that is the one that activates the people to tell them, look, we have to implement this law, and that way we start rejigging the process so that it suits the context and the problems that are present in society.
Finally, Leonard, you talk about fair tax regimes. Mm. Conversations even now in this election season.
Yeah.
Kenya Kwanza, conversation around state capture, how, individuals take the state and they manipulate policy for their own benefit. Some of its policies, tax policy.
Yes.
So we see owners of capital or people who have links to the state, who have businesses, have better tax incentives to do certain things.
Yes.
Or tax waivers.
Yes.
To do certain things. And we have seen this with you know, with individuals within the state who own things and, they didn't pay a certain tax or this or that. So, and then, but unfortunately, for the majority of Kenyans, I mean, the tax five types of license, which is actually a tax for him to start a business that may, and still have to be, still constantly be disturbed by, if it's in Nairobi, be disturbed by city, the city council, which in a sense they say it's a kind of tax that they collect.
Mm-hmm.
Or they say call it protection tax,
mm-hmm.
etc. How then do we start? What do we need to do to create within the legal space create a fair tax regime, such that for any society, for the dispossessed, marginalized, and alienated, that we're able to lift them up. But then, two, how also do you protect them from illegal taxes? So, for instance, when the police yes. when the police go and go collect money from matatu operators, mm. they say lipa ushuru. They say it, no, yes. pay your tax. Mm. When city council kanjo, as we call them in Kenya, when they go to shops and yes. bazaars and restaurants, and they say, listen, you know, we're coming to collect a fee. Mm. They in their minds that's a tax. Mm. How because this is two competing things. How yeah. do we one fix the taxes on the small person, but also how then do we secure mm. what in Kenya where it has become the illegal tax, it's really extortion.
Yeah. Yeah.
But Kenyans know it as tax because yeah. it's protection fee yeah. largely by the police, by the council officials
yes.
in some counties, by the county officials, again maybe not as much, but in some spaces also gangs in TC like the Mwangeki. How do we synthesize this?
That is a very good political question that we cannot avoid. Now, it may surprise you that when you ask a Kenyan or if you do a survey, what is the bigger problem we have here? They'll tell you number two is corruption, and number one is tax evasion and tax avoidance because of how permissive it is. Because for them, corruption is the theft from government. But when it comes to evasion, everyone is doing it, right? So you're sitting at a market, you pay the 100 shillings fee protection, but that means you won't pay the official fees.
Right.
You see? So there are those layered contradictions and paradoxes that can only be dealt with politically. Because the same way this fella is avoiding it at the marketplace, at the top, the other gentleman is getting an incentive in a political way, maybe as a kickback for financing a political campaign and so forth. So there is a serious political problem and a political issue we have to address in that sense. So it could be through goodwill, it could be through a policy change, a regulatory change, but this is essentially the mechanics of politics of tax that you have to be engaged in. Take, for instance, in the case of markets, every time they do that, you've been seeing in public people, actually market protests, I'd call them that. They go to the market and they shut them down. Like, hey, we've been paying the toll and the toilet is still not here. The sinks and whatnot for hygiene that you promised, and so we are shutting the market down. So you can see they take a very political approach to that issue. And they get it addressed. And so that is activated citizens taking the problem in their hands and looking for a solution. The same has to work out at the top. One thing we have been doing with colleagues in civil society, Okwa Uchumi and others, is watching out for the finance bill, making presentations in terms of which tax incentives need to go, which taxes need to stay at which level and so forth. Competing similar to the private sector, who also makes submissions there. And then the committee can make the decision or the recommendation that would be taken forward for approval. Now, what I learned from this is that, for instance, when we attended one session, I think that was in 2021, and we had finished our presentation and so forth, one of the MPs had taken a break, and when we met in the corridors, he said, thank you very much for showing up and at least putting in a civil society submission. I've been listening to private sector the whole day, and I've listened to government ministries, departmental agencies, because they also negotiate for the tax incentives that they need. And there was no single presentation that spoke up for Mwananchi. We now have something to make decisions on the basis of Mwananchi, which for him politically is in his interest as a representative, but also that being there and speaking to that and having it in black ink that there was this presentation gives you a basis to engage and make the change necessary and the considerations that you need for the society and Mwananchi and so forth. So I would encourage anyone, legal or not, who can always look out for some of those small newspaper calls for public participation to make an effort. Just go in and put in the submission. You learn on the way, you learn the templates, you learn the protocols, because sometimes you can be dismissed not attending that because you're not wearing a tie. But that's just a small hurdle. As long as you can put in that submission, it helps. And for instance, some of these VAT laws, they could have gone much higher if not for that kind of civil society participation. And another thing is public interest litigation. As I had mentioned, Omtata, TGNA had a case also in terms of double taxation agreements. I think Wanjiru Kikonyo also had a case about telling us about the SGR contracts. You can see. And what we discovered, for instance, with the DTA case, is that once that case stopped that process, now a lot of the double taxation agreements are being put forward for public participation. Not as many people might put in submissions, but at least now it's a wider pool of people who can at least make that submission and say, hey, this treaty needs to change this way.